Hi, Alexander Reed Ross. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Alexander Reed Ross is an investigative journalist, a research fellow at the Network Contagion Research Institute, and the lead author of two of their reports. First, Forecasting Distrust, a Nationwide Analysis of the Climate of Vaccine Hesitancy, and A Contagion of Institutional Distrust, Viral Disinformation of the COVID Vaccine and the Road to Reconciliation. In 2017, he wrote the book Against the Fascist Creep. Today, that creep has become a gallop. Led by Trump and his friends, close to a majority of the U.S. population believe the presidential election was stolen by the deep state in league with the Democratic Party, that all those malignant, shadowy figures intend to take away our guns and freedom and reduce us to vassals, and that these deep state actors are trying to use the COVID epidemic to teach us, to condition us, to habituate us, to force us to meekly give up all those hard-won freedoms. So, Alexander Reed Ross, how do you understand the rise of these right-wing conspiracy theories, not just as fringy weirdness, but as beliefs of a considerable percent of the Republican Party, a party that appears to have a reasonable chance of gaining political power in the federal government and most states? Why have so many people swallowed that Kool-Aid?
I think that a lot of this began really with the economic crisis that's built into 2008. As long ago as that, more people became disenfranchised and disillusioned with the sort of mainstream parties and their establishments, which had sort of run on the Washington consensus since the 1980s. And so what you started to get was on the left among liberals, more sort of populist class analysis, you know, and the rise of Bernie Sanders in Greece, you know, the rejection of the EU. And on the right, you started to get kind of more conspiracy theories about the liberal elites running the world, the globalists who are kind of insidiously involved in these vampiric cabals and stuff like that. And so I think Brexit was the first time that you saw an insurgent right wing taking this increasing dissent against international institutions and drawing in some left-wing tropes into a populist movement, which in the United States took on the form of Trumpism. And really what I think it kind of goes towards, as you know, the old saying about anti-Semitism being the socialism of fools, what we have is a group of people who are deeply economically angered and resentful in many political and cultural contexts. And rather than accept a left-wing systemic class analysis, they keep their prejudices through a manifestation of a kind of conspiracy theory outlook.
Yeah, let's talk about most of the lower three quarters of the United States. They've lost a great deal, it seems to me. I mean, particularly white people, of course. They've lost a great deal over the last 70 to 80 years. You talked about globalization, harder work, often contingent work, no set hours for lower pay, declining income and security. My sense is that an important thing is that the roles of the white working and even middle classes have been dishonored. Men no longer are the breadwinners, and then understand stay-at-home mothers stigmatized. The white privilege that benefited them is under attack. And unions have also been greatly weakened. Everybody is deeply in debt. How do those people then begin seeing themselves?
I think that you have to distinguish genuine grievances with the politics of rage and patriarchy. I think that you're right in some of those circumstances. In some cases, those complaints are the results of actual progress, though. And you do see some groups left behind simply because they adamantly refuse to adapt to a more equal society. So what do you say to people who want to complain about the fact that their white privilege doesn't make them relatively more powerful than others in the United States or even globally? And they want to fight and scratch and claw to once again rise to lord over non-white people. I think at a point there, you know, you have to lose that and just say racism and white supremacy don't help anybody. That kind of politics of prejudice only more deeply instills the inequalities and pits workers against one another rather than joining together in a multiracial working class. But I think back to your thoughts about COVID-19, it is fascinating how the convergence of these issues work. You have white men who seek a traditional power base. What they want is social power. And the irrationality of it is what has metastasized into this crippling hatred of medicine, science, and rationality. But the question you're putting to me, how do we get people to think more rationally? I think that's the most important question. And I think it has to do with the reality that we need more allies. We need to be able to understand our allies. We need to understand that not everybody has some kind of revolutionary class analysis. That's okay. It's better to work with people in the short term for hugely important needs, like ending a pandemic, than it is to keep a long-term and unrealistic goal that will wind up only reinforcing these kinds of chauvinistic politics of the right.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Alexander Reed Ross, investigative journalist, a research fellow at the Network Contagion Research Institute, and the lead author of several of their reports. He's been studying the right in great depth for the last almost 10 years, the danger they pose, also how to deal with them to reduce their numbers and strength. So far, we've been discussing why so many people have drunk the Kool-Aid of the U.S. right, believe the election was stolen. Of course, the Republican Party is a tent of many different positions, including our corporate friends make up its elite. They've lost a lot of power in the Republican Party. We'll get to, again, the issue of how to deal with it. But how did so many people get radicalized within the Republican Party?
I don't think that the Republican Party has shied away from the corporate elite whatsoever. I mean, you can look at Donald Trump and recognize the rampant real estate speculation that came about in the wake of the foreclosure crisis after 2008, and look at the fruits that it's borne. But I think that that's a big part of the radicalization of the right, the sort of the idea that, you know, Obama is bailing out the banks and not the people. This is all about Wall Street and not Main Street. You did see a lot of sort of Pat Buchanan wing of the U.S. right wing start to lead a larger and larger contingent, especially among younger organizers and right wingers like Richard Spencer, who really starts kind of working within that milieu in 2008 and 2009 around the American Conservative and Talkies magazine, going on to form, you know, alternative right and the alt-right in general. So you start to see this massive disillusionment happening with not just liberalism, but the consensus between the right and the left that really went into effect towards the end of the Cold War, which sort of stipulated that under the conditions of mass incarceration and racialized policing in the United States, the middle class would be allowed to sort of swell its ranks amid, you know, Iraq war and sort of glut from global resource extraction. But that didn't pan out, right? The accumulation of capital basically swept up a lot of people's futures in the meat grinder of the foreclosure crisis from 2008 to 2014 and on. So I think that a lot of people on the right may not have even been affected by that. A lot of them were still in the middle class through that, and you still saw most poor people, most sort of lower working class people voting Democrat, voting for Hillary Clinton. But you saw more middle class people becoming resentful and angry and actually identifying as working class. So you saw a growing producerism coming about as part of, in a sense, the national mood, but really an international mood and a really a transnational movement of the radical right to embrace fascists within the movement and actually holds the line, as it were, to the right of the establishment conservative politicians. So you started in France, for example, you saw the decline not only of the conventional Socialist Party, but also of the conventional Republicans of France, right? Fillon and, of course, Sarkozy and people like that. You saw the rise of the Alternative for Germany in areas of Eastern Germany, and you saw the rise of the Lega Party in Italy in what had been traditionally sort of the industrial north and the reddest, you know, communist parts of Italy. Similar story with the UK. And of course, in the Rust Belt in the US. So a lot of this, I think, has to do not only with class, not only with poor people rising up, but also with the transformation, the structural transformation of capitalist modes of production from industrialization and the industrial proletariat to the service industry, to tech work, to part-time gigs. And as you were saying, a kind of decentralization and flexibility of the labor force that makes union organizing all the more complicated and difficult. So on the global scale, this transformation of the capitalist mode of accumulation has opened the door for, you know, global billionaires to the extent that it wasn't ever dreamed possible. You know, you have billionaires launching themselves off into space and talking about the United States government as if it was a weaker corporation. So it's sort of brought in an era of financial lawlessness, in a sense, cryptocurrencies, sort of renegade billionaires funding disinformation and creating their own populist cults. But in the meantime, while you have that sort of lawlessness, you also have the rise of vigilantism as people feel like progress made by liberals and made by the left in the United States, among other places, has really outpaced the previous racialized law enforcement consensus, which was always implicit but tacit in this conversion from a manufacturing-based, what James and Grace Lee Boggs used to call a warfare-welfare state, into a financialized, part of me wants to say neo-feudal tendency, but that's a bit sort of projected into the future. So what we have to deal with is a right wing that is mutating. And it's mutating not just because Donald Trump is a bad leader and he's a real mean fascist. It's mutating not just because there's transnational solidarity among authoritarians from Putin to Trump and so on. It's mutating because of our real social and material conditions, our real economic conditions. And we haven't had any theorists coming out and spelling out a strategy for adapting to these circumstances outside of, on the one hand, a sort of France-like investment in a Marxian model of industrial proletariat organizing, or a totally chaotic, openly schizophrenic model of multitudinous insurrection, kind of based on an autonomous social movement model. So I don't know if there is any kind of solid left-wing project to counter the transformation of material conditions. And in the meantime, what fills that gap are these self-organized, but also more or less wealthy, I mean, like middle to upper class networks of right-wingers who are increasingly radicalized to the point of increasingly supporting their own local, not just militias, but vigilante units. And so we do see, in a sense, the disintegration of a federal system and a kind of ground-up resurrection of a Confederate horizontalism. And I don't mean horizontalism as in like everybody's equal. I mean horizontalism as in, I mean, you mentioned vassals before, but certainly in the context of a more patrimonial structure of relations and loyalty bonds.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Alexander Reed Ross, an investigative journalist, senior analyst at the Center for the Analysis of the Radical Right, So far, we've been discussing why so many people have drunk the Kool-Aid of the U.S. far right, believe the election was stolen, that COVID epidemic is a hoax, and that the left is the Antichrist, communist seeking totalitarian rule. If this is true, that raises the question of the day. How can that be countered? How can we contribute to their rethinking? How can we convince them that we share with them critiques of many aspects of what the U.S. has become? So, Alex Ross, let's discuss that, how to engage people in that conversation, and then we can conclude with other ways of reaching and influencing them to, if not instantly, win their support, at least place doubts and rethink their ideas about us.
No, it's an interesting question. I think in some cases it's so difficult because the state of strain, tension, and violence in the country at this point makes conversation impractical. But where conversation can exist, I think there has to be an acknowledgement of mutual shared interest and a serious confrontation with what we want our futures to look like. I think when we look at the far right, we see a lot of vigilante violence and we see a lot of basically anti-science talking points or libertarian paranoia. But really, the far right is also an immensely complicated political area, and it's very paradoxical. As I said, a lot of the radicalization of people on the right really started with economic anxiety and the disillusionment with a liberal consensus, or a neoliberal consensus, I should say. And that is shared across the population. You also have people on the right who believe themselves to be anti-racists, even more so than anti-racist activists who right-wingers believe are just making things worse by stirring things up. And I think that you have to get into the problems of white fragility there, that people who insist that they are the most anti-racist people are often the least inclined to actually listen to others who say, you know, you're not doing the right thing here, or like you should listen to other people and that sort of thing. So there are complicated problems that lead to racism from positions that are honestly inclined towards an anti-racist and anti-capitalist attitude. And I think we need to understand those tendencies and how that happens. Of course, there have been a number of really important texts written about white fragility and that sort of thing, white privilege, as you say. And we really need to understand those and treat them respectfully and use that knowledge in our conversations with people who don't necessarily agree with us. Because if we aren't careful, we will escalate situations beyond the realm of communication and compromise and building a better society, which is what we need to do. And I'm not saying that everybody starts from a place where conversation is possible. There's obviously a place where self-defense is actually necessary and you can't converse, but that doesn't stop people. You know, I've been to anti-racist rallies where, you know, right-wingers show up, and I've seen, you know, anti-racist protesters who are constantly demonized in the media put in so much work and good faith effort to try to engage these people who are there standing there with guns and yelling "All Lives Matter" and that sort of thing. So what I see in this country is really a country being torn apart, and a country that doesn't want to be torn apart, but also a very stubborn willingness to resort to harming people who otherwise might be their friends, based not even on an argument over principles, but really an argument over how those principles manifest in everyday life. So it's incredibly frustrating, and I don't feel like this kind of fighting is even necessary. And I don't feel even that those who are engaging in it always feel that it's necessary either. In fact, I don't think that people want what's happening to happen. But in order to stop it, I think we need more solidarity, and we need to change these social and material conditions that are systematically dismantling the fundamental predicates of a rational society. And that's already happening. You know, that's happening with Amazon workers going on strike, with the Nabisco workers, with the John Deere workers You can rattle off a number of companies that have actually successfully and joyfully taken to the picket lines because they're trying to better their own world. And it's not just a question of their own lives. This is a question about the future generations and standing up for the people of this country in opposition to selfishness and greed, and actually like touching part of this society that's still human and that wants to coexist in relationship of love and freedom.
Right. I think, let me list a few other tremendous assets that the left has right now in creating the conversations and in winning some support from and gaining the confidence of working people. Most of them still vote Democratic, of course, but still a rising majority, especially of white people, have moved towards conservative positions. And that explains part of the loss of power for the centrist and liberal left. I mean, for one thing, it seems to me we can look back when the Green New Deal, the idea of it was sweeping the country, and Bernie Sanders was an enormously popular politician, even with a lot of people who now have been organized by the right and might not want to admit that. Unfortunately, we did have that opportunity. I think you're right. The people are not fascist. Their values and their behavior really clash on the right. It seems to me that a lot of them claim to be anti-racist and think they are anti-racist, and some of their friends at work are black and brown. Now, not all of them. There's certainly anti-Semitic and anti-black white supremacist types, but the base of the Republican Party is not that, even though they vote for people and put people in power who will maintain the various inequalities and discriminations that are implicit in our economic system. But I also think that climate change, that's one sign of hope that we really could, on a national level, with the Progressive Caucus and the Congress, who are mixed, but many of them see the need for the Democratic Party. And it almost happened, it seems to me, that the Democratic Party and the U.S. state offered to working people enormous gains in the Build Back Better movement. And the loss of it, seems to me, was a great setback for building from remnants of the Democratic Party and so many other independent people and the left, if it could get together, we could see a fairly powerful bloc that might be able to face the problems that the Democrats have failed to face.
In order to build movements like that, we need commitment to integrity and a politics of unity. We can't rely on those representatives to deliver those things because they're a minority within Congress and a minority within Senate, not to say the general population. So given the system that we have, what can we help to bring about? And we can't do it through disinformation, through sneaky dark money funding, or through support for authoritarianism. We have to build our own movement based on our relationships and based on trust. That's the most important thing to me. The left is not going to get anywhere if we can't trust each other, and we're not going to be able to trust each other if we can't be honest.
Yeah, I don't believe that the Democratic Party is going to be the agent of radical change. I do think that some kinds of reforms can be won in the state, especially in that our political economy is going to have to change radically in the next 5, 10, 20 years, depending on how our global roasting, the particular forms it takes and the damage it's done.
No, I completely agree. I think, you know, what we're seeing now with the kind of Elon Musk type of characters and the Bezos types of characters is the outcome of a system that believed, in some cases, genuinely, that if regulations and taxes were lifted, then a rising tide would lift all boats. Basically, more production would happen. And so with more production, everybody's wage would increase. And I do believe that the social wage for many people in the United States, but all over the world, has increased over the last 40 years. But I don't believe that it has increased satisfactorily, despite the fact that you can say we have nicer cars now, we have better computers, we have access even to better food. I don't believe that you could say the improvement in the social wage has matched the increase in potential social wage. So that is really the question that we need to grapple with. What parts of our society are still sort of backwards? You know, what parts of our economy are still not working for people despite the massive gains that we've made? So yeah, I think you're right. It's not a question so much of the economy outpacing political responses and the politics needing to adapt to the rapidly changing economy. No, it's a question of the political economy, as you put it, having established a certain state and a need to transform that state in order to ensure that people get the kind of life that they deserve.
Alexander Reed Ross, I think we have to end now. My guess is that at some point we could, in fact, agree almost completely as to what the promise that is now before us, as well as the potential for unmitigated tragedy that also seems to lurk in the future if we cannot solve our problems. Alexander Reed Ross, thanks a lot for talking to us. Why don't you tell us how we can access your articles and other communications?
Thanks very much for having me, Bill. I am a senior fellow at the Center for Analysis of the Radical Right, so you can go to that website and find my latest blog posts there. I also write for Haaretz and The Daily Beast. Like you said, I'm a data analyst at the Network Contagion Research Institute. So we have some reports out about COVID-19 and vaccine dissemination or distribution and equality. So you can find some reports there as well. And I'm on Twitter at AREIDROSS at A. Reed Ross. That's my name.
Boy, you keep your pen and pencils and fingers busy. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure.